is a presentation of the Match Talk Podcast Network.
Hello, wrestling fans. It's time for the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. World Wrestling Resource was made that you as a wrestler, parent, coach, or fan can have access to all the resources of the very best in the world of wrestling. I'm three-time wrestling writer and broadcaster of the year, Jason Bryant, and I want you to join me, along with John McGovern and world champions Terry Brands and Dennis Hall, as we talk training tips, topical discussion, mental preparation, and more on the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. World Wrestling Resource is sponsored by Defense Soap. Find World Wrestling Resource on Facebook at facebook.com/World Wrestling Resource and follow us on Twitter at WWRESO and, of course, on the web at worldwrestlingresource.com. Now on to the show as we join John McGovern, Terry Brands, and Dennis Hall. Welcome back to World Wrestling Resource. My name is Jason Bryant. Today, our guest is former member of the U.S. World Team, Joe Heskett, multiple-time All-American. He's a guy who spent some time in Ames, did some pretty good stuff, was a coach, was an administrator, has done a lot of things. Now he's working back on his leadership. His name is Joe Heskett. Joe, been a while since we talked. Welcome to the program.
Oh, I appreciate it, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just get right to brass tacks. What are you up to these days? Joe Heskett, you've kind of fallen off the wrestling map, at least for a little bit, and I understand that's going to change, but what does Joe Heskett do on a day-to-day business side of things these days?
Well, you know, it's just the quick backdrop is from coaching to administration. I was a senior-level administrator at West Virginia University the last 3 years, was the head coach at West Point prior to that, then with the Buckeyes as an assistant. So it's, you know, my path, I always knew I wanted to do more than just coach, at least to get the experience, right, Jason? At least see what college sport's all about. And probably 6 months ago, I departed with West Virginia University, the administrative role, and I've been focused on full-time focus on leadership. I'm doing some coaching again, which I didn't necessarily expect, but that's just kind of how it carved out. And I'm actually finishing up my doctorate in student development and organizational leadership. So for me, to put that in summation, you know, I just want to be able to put myself in a position to be able to give back to the sport and create some flexibility and do what I love.
Yeah, and the H leadership thing, this is something you had actually started in the works, I guess, right after your senior level career ended. I think you were still coaching at Army when the H leadership thing started to pop up. And when you say working in leadership, what does that exactly mean?
Well, I can tell you, H leadership actually started in 2009, and really the goal behind H leadership was to revolutionize sports through character and leadership development. I've always been a guy that's looked very close at coaches, sports, the intangibles. What are kids getting out of sport? How are they getting things out of sport? So I've always looked at that very closely, and that's one of the reasons why I went back to further my education as well. And it's really an ideal blend of experience, right, having wrestled at the highest level, and then combining that with the education and some of the evidential support behind some of this stuff. So when you ask me what is leadership, H leadership is really about character and leadership development. So I work with coaches, parents, athletes, and at the end of the day, it's really about creating or reconstructing or really constructing a system where people can benefit through sport and be more prepared for life through what they're learning in sport. And there's a system to that, because coaching is just not about the technical and tactical. And oftentimes we get sucked up into that, especially at the high school and college and even pro level, because our goal is to win. But I really want to look at it from a developmental approach and from a leadership perspective. That's one of the things I'm focused on with H leadership is it's helping parents, coaches, and athletes figure out ways to really help the young man or woman benefit to be more prepared in life.
Yeah, and let's just clarify that leadership doesn't mean that every person is going to be, you know, SCA president or on the student council in college or their team captain. It just means leading in different ways, whether it's, okay, I'm going to take the initiative to fold my clothes or do the chores without being asked. That type of leadership also goes in it. So my question really comes around, we have, in the sport of wrestling, the element of toughness to it. And I've always believed that when kids start wrestling, There are some that are naturally tough. They gravitate to the sport. They're rough and tumble kids. They immediately answer the bell when it comes to the toughness aspect of the sport. Whereas others, they don't have that toughness that immediately. It's not an innate sense. They have to learn that. They become tough by being put in tough situations. How does that kind of parallel to what leadership does? Because some people we hear are born leaders. What about those who are not born leaders that have to learn the leadership just like they have to learn that toughness in the sport of wrestling?
Well, you bring up a great point because it, leadership, one, it's an action. And our definition of leadership is a communications relationship. So at the end of the day, when it comes to coaching, it's figuring out how to not just motivate, but actually instill not solely values. Values are very important, but instill character and traits that help young men and women understand who they are. And to your point, it's not a position. It's not that I'm the team captain. It's what you do with it. It's how you communicate and you relate to others. So there's really an art behind that, just like there's an art behind learning how to be mentally tough or learning math or becoming good at your job. So that's what's really neat about this. And from my perspective, looking at it so closely, coaching is a wonderful profession. But coaches aren't necessarily taught how to lead. And young men and women aren't taught how to lead just because of sport. So you actually have to have a system in place that works together in order to have these developmental outcomes. So there's a little bit, if I may speak frankly, quite a big disconnect with how people go about developing other people, especially in the sport world where coaches are developing athletes. And then you have the parent dynamic and how all that works. So it's really kind of a neat, and I know a lot of people do care about this stuff, especially parents, but it's a really neat field to break down and to look at and to dissect. So to your point, it's not a whole lot different than developing mental toughness, but there's strategy, there's education, and there's experience. You got to put yourself in it.
And this program isn't just geared for wrestling. This is something that transcends all sports with your leadership. But what are some things that you've seen that maybe the opportunities in being in college athletics and dealing with more than just wrestling has shown you that our sport is a lot more similar to the other sports in the college athletics world and in youth sports than we realize?
Let me start out by answering your question about this isn't just a wrestling thing. This is absolutely not a sports-specific thing. This is a life thing. One of the things I'm very fortunate about is I have a mentor in the organizational leadership and executive coaching space. I work with a company called Priority Thinking. So we do a lot of stuff with organizations, companies, high-level executives, and it is amazing the crossover. When I look at it from a leadership perspective of what's going on in some of these Fortune 500 companies and what's going on in sports. So, this goes from C-suite level down to youth coaches because leadership transcends through that medium, entirely through that medium. So it's been really neat to work with Priority Thinking. And for those listeners that are really looking to enhance their own leadership, regardless of what role you're in, that's what we do from a standpoint with Priority Thinking. And with Ace Leadership, it's primarily through youth sport. Like I said, parents, coaches, and athletes. To answer the second part of your question, the sport of wrestling, it really isn't much different than any of the sports. When I was an associate AD on the senior staff at West Virginia University, I was involved in all sports, and I spent a lot of time with the football team. And they're, again, very similar to what I just said with the corporate America space, the sports space. Within sport, whether you're dealing with football or rowing or wrestling, how you develop people, how you communicate, how you teach, and the structure in which you teach, and the emphasis, right, as well as the investment on what you have for that structure, are all key in the development of people.
You've had quite the life growing up. Some of these are well documented, some of them not so much, because it's been a number of years since you last competed on the college mats and internationally, but how much do you draw inspiration from this leadership course, from the situations you had to grow up with as a youth?
Jason, that is a great question. And, I've just been wired this way. I've always thought this way. I, people don't know this story. I'm going to give you a quick, maybe minute and a half story. You know, I'm removed now a little bit from the scene, but there's still people that remember my days and my heart condition, which ended my career when I was the number one man on the Olympic ladder and, you know, four-time All-American, wrestled in the national finals three times, and Kale and I were 33-34-0, his teammates going into college as freshmen, so the sports were really good to me. But at the end of the day, I've always looked at it bigger than sport, always. So when I was being recruited out of high school as a three-time state champ out of Ohio, I was getting recruited by some of the best places in the country. Now, for those real wrestling fanatics, I wrestled for a school called Walsh Jesuit. Back in the 90s, Walsh Jesuit was just straight beast mode. And we won four national titles, and we wrestled everybody from the 94 to 96, or like 93 to 96, 97 era. Bottom line is, when I was getting recruited, Ohio State was recruiting me, and I loved the Buckeyes. But what was happening was I saw that a lot of my teammates, who were also multiple state champions, were going there, and they weren't lasting a semester. This is just facts, right? A lot of these great kids were on national championship teams. Now, the way I was wired and still am, I'm observing this, and I'm really asking the question, why? What's going on? And so I actually did not even go on my recruiting trip to Ohio State because I knew in my heart that wasn't the culture at that time that I wanted to be around to help me reach my goals. So I didn't even go to visit the Buckeyes as much as I loved them. So to answer your question, growing up, not only was my grandmother an instrumental part of it and the people that helped me, because I grew up with my grandmother, never knew my dad. My mom died when I was young. So I had to deal with all that. And I really think looking back on it, I dealt with it without even knowing, from a leadership perspective, and really trying to think, how can I get better from here? And that went into my decision of going to Iowa State University with Coach Bobby Douglas, because I believe that he would develop me as a whole person, and he absolutely did that. I loved my time in Ames, Iowa.
Yeah, speaking of Coach Douglas a little bit, he's also been outspoken, and not to make everything about race, but he has been very outspoken about our race relations in this country and, of course, in the sport of wrestling. How much did you have to battle with race growing up because of your background?
You know, that's another great question. You know, I think I was a little bit ignorant to it sometimes because I'm not always looking at myself, right? I mean, I don't look down and always assess the color of my skin, but as I got older, I started realizing a little bit more and a little bit more that people are, and it's a very, very real real systematic issue that we have in America, and it certainly impacts people's lives. And really, if we just take race out of it for a second and just look at privilege and oppression, right? Just privilege, people that have things that they don't even necessarily have earned just because of race or because of religion preference or because of gender, and the oppression side of that, right? Some people, they do not have certain things because of who they are or where they live. I am not saying that they can't learn it or work towards it, but that is a very real dynamic in our country. And I know Bobby has been through a lot, especially growing up in the time period that he did. So, no, he's an advocate for the right reasons. And sometimes it's difficult for non-minorities to really understand where a minority is coming from. And so those that, especially, you know, minorities that understand where Bobby's coming from, and non-minorities, but the minorities that understand where Bobby's coming from, it's very clear to them because they've lived that lifestyle in one way or another and have had to deal with those types of things. So for me personally, I've had to deal with it. I don't think I realized how much I was dealing with it at points, but I will say this. I was unbelievably fortunate to be around amazing people. My time in Ames, Iowa was some of the best times of my life, and that's a predominantly white state. And people there genuinely cared, regardless of race, about people. And that kind of shone through, and I've been around that a lot of my life. So I haven't been immune to racism, but I've experienced it. But I've also been around such great people and great communities that it's elevated beyond race.
And just to clarify for those who might be wondering, you're of mixed race, correct?
Correct. Yeah, my mother was white, father was black.
Yeah, so if people are wondering why, you know, the racial issue comes up, I just have to explain it, because that being biracial has its own set of stipulations, where sometimes you may have people look at you as like, okay, there's that privileged side, and then there's the other side that you just touched on. So you've got an experience probably on both sides of that fence in that regard. But getting back to the leadership role, again, with those life choices and things, wrestling, talking about the ability to be great. You talked about coming in with Cale Sanderson. I mean, you guys battled in high school. It was one of the best classes that we had seen in the modern era, but you go 3-2-2-1. When you are so close to achieving that goal with such high expectations from a powerhouse like Walsh Jesuit to a powerhouse at Iowa State, how much does falling short of those goals ultimately help you beyond the athletic side of things?
It's all about mindset. It's all about preparation. One of the things that I've seen is so many of these athletes, they crumble when sport is not around. We always talk about adversity builds character, et cetera. All those phrases are great, but I will tell you something. One of my pet peeves is walking into a building and seeing signs, character, integrity, transparency, et cetera. And quite frankly, I'm tired of seeing that, knowing that the culture is really nothing about that. And it's fascinating because it goes to your point about shortcomings, right? Learning these things. Having a great leadership structure around you helps you learn these things. You're going to learn things by yourself through experiences. But one of the things that helped me was I always had great people around me, and I was kind of introspective when I thought a lot to figure out how can I leverage this. Now, I'll tell you, some of the most painful times in sport was when I lost. I lost 9 times in college, Jason, 8 of them were in overtime. I'm a guy that got diagnosed with a rare heart condition, you know, 5 years after college that should have technically killed me at a 2% chance to live, right? I will never, ever make an excuse, not even close, that my heart had something to do with those losses. But my point is, that's how close I was to being potentially undefeated, you know, having 9 losses, 8 of them in overtime. Bottom line to answer your question is this. A lot of people have a hard time adjusting, and not just in the sport of wrestling, but in sport in general. I know a lot of football players and gymnasts, and when that sport ends, they're just lost. And it comes back to the ability of coaches and parents to really help an institution, right, collegiate institutions, to help construct something where these young men and women understand how to leverage adversity and springboard that to be successful in life. And that's really what leadership's all about.
When it comes down to 2002 in Albany, which is, oddly enough, the first year I went to the NCAA championships, you beat Matt Lackey in the finals, a finally type of moment. When we talk about coming up short, what's the payoff when you finally come up at the end of the podium and hit one for a high school, a college wrestler? That's the immediate goal, is an NCAA championship before you go to the Olympic and world level. But you get that championship in Albany in the snow. It's cold. And then Cale Sanderson, your teammate, makes history a couple weight classes after you. Wrap that up emotionally and what that meant to be so close, and finally hit that achievement that you've been working for.
Well, you know, knowing that you're the best, right? Not you know, pretty good or whatever the case may be, but knowing, because this sport, like most sports, but this sport's different. Wrestling is different because it's me versus you. So there's an ego with humility that needs to really find its balance. Because when I walk out on the mat, or the best walk out on the mat, you better believe we're thinking we're the baddest dude. You know, I always love Joe Warren, you know, baddest man on the planet. You better believe that, Joe. And obviously he won world championship and made that happen. But the bottom line is it's a mindset. So even though I lost in the NCAA finals twice and took third my freshman year, I was highly disappointed because I knew I was the best. I'd beaten all those guys. There's not a guy that I didn't lose to in college that I hadn't beaten. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's really about focus and belief. So even though I took third, second, my belief was still that I am the best wrestler. I just have to prove it. And that's what it really comes down to in anything. So when you talk about my senior year winning it, you want to talk about it's about time relief. that was one of them, because it wasn't like I hadn't won in the past. I won university titles, but that NCAA title was elusive. And all 3 years in the NCAA, I lost in overtime or double overtime. So it was really, really close. So that was an unbelievable time period, because not only was I able to achieve my personal goals, but, you know, Cale and I, like you said, we wrestled in high school. We wrestled in Reno by junior year, I think it was. We wrestled in Fargo our junior year. we wrestled in our freshman year of college. And so I've known Cale for, we were on the same world team back in 1994. So to be able to watch him and experience that with him was amazing. It was awesome. It's one of the most memorable things I'll ever do in sport was to be part of that run. And I couldn't tell you how proud I am of him. And some people will say, people go, well, aren't you jealous? You know, you were there. You lost 9 times. And you know, that's pretty good. But, no, I tried my best. Jealousy, are you kidding me? What Cale did has nothing to do with me. That's a complete, that's what Cale did. I have almost equal amount of pride of what he did as opposed to, you know, in comparison to what I did, because what he did was phenomenal. And I love being a part of that ride.
When you look at the world of wrestling now, and you see Cale bringing in all sorts of monster recruits, people just come into Penn State. They want to be part of the program, come into Penn State. Did you see early on in his career as a teammate that he might, you know, does he embody the traits that at H Leadership kind of does that makes people want to wrestle for him, and Cody and Casey Cunningham? I mean, what do you see from maybe a distance that you'd seen firsthand as him as an athlete that say, you know, this Cale Sanderson guy is not just a good coach, he's a good leader too?
So people love winners. They love them. And Cale Sanderson is the one. And one of the most impressive things about Cale, because I actually thought initially, and I know Cale's personality relatively well, I thought Cale was going to take him some time to transition into college coaching, especially as a young coach, knowing his personality and I thought he'd be a very good coach. But one of the things that he did, and I knew it when it happened, he surrounded himself with amazing people. I know Cody very well. And Casey is one of the best. You know, there's a couple competitors that I have the utmost respect for. And I just truly value as human beings. Donnie Pressloff, Casey Cunningham, or Miko Blackman. You know, these are guys that I scrapped with, right? And I have nothing but love for them. So when Cale started orchestrating and assembling his staff and put Cody where he is, and it was just masterful, right? So not only do you have a winner, not only do you have a guy that cares and is passionate and intelligent, but he had a growth curve, which I knew he was going to have. So I'm watching, seeing how is he going to handle this? And he handled it like the way you should have, and you're seeing him reap the rewards. Because not only is he a great guy, but what he's done is he surrounded himself with great people, and you're watching the results. And I can say the same thing about Tom Ryan at Ohio State and what he's done. And you know, Lou Roselli and just that connection and being able to bring home a national title for the Buckeyes. There's some great stuff going on in our sport. And quite honestly, Jason, I don't think it's covered enough nationally. When we do these things with ESPN and all that kind of stuff, these stories need to be entrenched and marketed into the world so that people understand what's really going on. Because some of the stories going on in wrestling is, to me, just as exciting as some of the things going on in football. It's just not out there for the public to see.
Well, sometimes it's about what sells papers and what gets ratings. And as much as the purity aspect of wrestling, that's something we've had to contend with for years. And I think we all know that. I think you're preaching to the choir there. One last thing on Cale, before we move into your international career and other things regarding the world of college athletics, is he was the head coach at Iowa State. He had come on after Bobby Douglas and then left after a couple years. What was your opinion on the rationale for him heading to Iowa State? And then now looking back at it years later, Iowa State gets aggressive, throws some big money at a guy like Kevin Dresser, who was an accomplished wrestler, built two monster programs as a high school coach, built a monster program at Virginia Tech. I mean, just from an outsider's perspective as an alum, what's it like to see what happened when Cale left to where the program is now with the new hire in Kevin Dresser?
So first and foremost, when Cale left, the way I'm wired, I don't look at things of how it affects me when it doesn't affect me, right? I mean, Cale's decision is Cale's decision, regardless whether it's our alma mater or not. So when Cale made his decision, I actually said, good for him. He's doing that for a reason. He's doing that because it's best for him. And I'll use a quick analogy or a quick comparison with LeBron James. I was a little bummed when he left Cleveland, but he's doing it for a reason, and look why he did it. So these guys, again, they're smart. They know why they're doing it. And Cale put himself in position to be arguably, you know, one of the best coaches of all time, and he's doing a very, very useful career. So I thought that was outstanding. He did what he had to do. As for my, you know, alma mater, that's where hiring comes in, right? If Cale leaves, get somebody with the pedigree that can build a national championship team and compete. I love Kevin Jackson. Obviously, he had his struggles there, and they bring in Dresser. And I think Dresser has a track record that's been a proven winner. So can he do it in AM? I hope so. I wish him nothing but the best. He's put a great staff together. I've always enjoyed watching those guys, and I wish him the very best.
Moving to Baku, 2007. You're on the world team. It's your only world team appearance at the senior level. You finished fifth. You're wrestling for a medal. And what was in just a trip to Baku? It was, again, my first NCAA championships was one where you won. My first international trip ever, first time I ever left the country outside of going to Canada, which kind of really doesn't count, especially when you drive across the border, was to Baku. You're on that team. What is the situation as far as the heart situation? I've said situation twice. What is the process of when you get done with the tournament to when you realize there is a big problem here?
So I'm going to back up, Jason. I'm going to tell you, and I don't know. I'm going to tell you and the audience a quick story, and I'll make it very brief. But this is a pretty powerful story.
No need to be brief. This is the best thing about a podcast. It's as long as it needs to be. So feel free.
Gotcha. Well, this is something that only a handful of us know, and it's the first time I've ever stood on air. So probably a week and a half before we left for Baku, we're out training at the Olympic Training Center. And I'm exhausted. My body's exhausted. I train hard. People sometimes watch me wrestle and they would say, man, he looks like he's out of shape. But trust me, in college and internationally, I worked when people didn't see me working. Obviously, looking back, you know, there was some internal stuff I was fighting. My body was not oxygenating properly. My heart was not working properly. So that's kind of some of the reasons why the fatigue was happening. So anyway, we're at the Olympic Training Center, and we're having a team meeting. And it's myself, you know, all Team USA, and many of those guys made the Olympic team the next year. Schwab, Baddick, Cormier, a few other guys were in there. But the coaching staff was Kevin Jackson, Terry McCoy, Terry Brand. I think maybe Mike DeRoe was in there. And we're talking very candidly, very open about some different things. And it starts to get a little bit heated, right? And I remember looking at Terry McCoy, and I love Terry. And I think everybody that was associated with that world team after my heart condition was like, wow, it really hit them. And a reason it hit them, part of it was this conversation that happened behind the scenes. So we're sitting in this room, and Terry starts talking to me in front of all the team about responding. He's kind of talking in generalities, right? Responding during practice and not taking a knee, and it's kind of general. And I looked at him, and I said, Terry, what are you saying? And then he basically says, all right, Joe. He goes, you're taking a knee during practice after our live goes. You're taking a knee, and we need you to stand up. We need you to respond. We need you bouncing around. And I said this. And you can ask any of them. I said, listen, I don't know what it is, but my body works differently. And I turned around and I pointed right to Doug Schwab. Because Doug Schwab and Zadik are growers, right? And I said, my body works different than Schwab. It works different than Zadik. I said, I'm not making excuses. I just know how my body is. So when I take a knee, I'm taking a knee for a reason, because that's the best way for me to recoup. I don't know why that is, but when I stand up, I have a harder time recouping. So I said, but folks, I said, just so we're on the same page, tomorrow during practice, I'm going to respond. When you tell me, when the whistle blows and it goes over, I'm going to stand up, I'm going to focus on bouncing. Well, guess what, Jason? That next day, we're going, he goes, not that you're not wrestling hard. He goes, so I need you to respond, and all the coaches were in agreement, et cetera. So we got in this pretty heated argument about that, right? And I'm looking at my teammates, pointing at them. So the next day of practice, I'm wrestling, live go ends, you know, we're going live. I stand up to try to respond. I look over at Terry. Terry's looking at me. And I said, nope. And I went right back down on my knee to catch my breather. And he was fired up. I don't think he was very happy with that. But quite honestly, I didn't care that he was happy. I needed to catch my breath the way I needed to catch it. And then within 10 days later, I went into sudden cardiac arrest. So there is, there's a pretty powerful story to kind of put a synopsis over, you know, what that world team experience was like, what trying to deal with that heart condition was like, not knowing that I had it, And then obviously everybody pretty much in shock what had happened. And looking back on that that training experience and some of the other things that went on during those few weeks of preparation.
So where were you when the cardiac arrest happened again? You were back stateside, right?
Oh. Yeah, we had just gotten back to the state. It was 5 days after the World Championships, and I was in the Ohio State wrestling room. I literally was 10 steps from my athletic trainer, and I walked over to him, and I said, something's not right. I'm not feeling right. And within 15 minutes, my body shut down.
So have you've thought about if this would have happened in Baku, would we be talking
anywhere?
Right now?
No. I had a 2% chance to live, and really the reason I lived was because I was at a medical facility.
Yeah, there was a certified athletic trainer right there that said, okay, that was trained and how to handle this type of thing.
Well, he called the ambulance. He took me into the training room, couldn't find my pulse, couldn't find my blood pressure, and called the ambulance immediately. And I actually said to him, there's no reason to call the ambulance. Within 4 minutes, I was knocked out. So it was pretty intense. And he did a phenomenal job. Phenomenal, phenomenal job he did. He did not mess around. And, you know, he just did the right things, too. And that day just aligned, right? I wasn't too prideful to say I'm going to fight this off. I went to him early on. He did what he needed to do. He called the ambulance. And the last thing I remember, the ambulance came in and they said, this is a true medical emergency.
So after that, knowing that you had been competing with something like this for so long, was this a conversation to the doctors? You are done. You are never going to wrestle again. This is literally less than a year before the Olympic trials. You're the number one guy. Ben Askren makes the team that year, but you were likely the favorite in that respect, even though, you know, Askren's style was pretty interesting. But what is that conversation like when they tell you you cannot wrestle anymore?
Oh, it was hard. And I had wrestled Askren that year, and I beat Askren and all those other guys. And, you know, so and I had only gotten better through the World Championship. So, you know, I had a pretty good thing going. But when they told me I wasn't going to wrestle again, and I remember that moment, I didn't believe it. I didn't believe it. I actually knew I was going to get a device put in my chest, and I was going to wrestle and win a World Olympic medal with the device in my chest. That's what I believed until 3 weeks later when that device shocked me. and it was like a million volts of electricity running through my body and it dropped me. I realized then that this is very serious and I probably am done wrestling.
Yeah, so explain that situation. When you say shocked you, what did it do? It's a pacemaker, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, it's an internal cardiac defibrillator and it has a pacemaker combo. So yes, it basically detects my heart condition, and if my heart arrhythmia goes out of whack, it will shock me to slow the heart rate down.
Okay,
so
yeah.
So basically, Jason, and for you in the audience, what happened was my heart, I have something called RV dysplasia, and it sent me into something called ventricular tachycardia. And ventricular tachycardia is the most deadly heart arrhythmia known to mankind. So what ends up happening is my heart rate went up about 280 beats per minute, which is unsustainable. And it's beating so fast that it's not oxygenating blood. And that arrhythmia, literally, it tries to kill me. And the device in my chest will shock me to try to bring that arrhythmia back down into a stable or normal mode. So that's what was happening when the shocks occurred.
So how often does that happen now that you're not a competitive athlete? Does this happen on you know, once a month, once a year? How often do you have shocks like that?
Fortunately, thank goodness, I have not had one since. They changed my medication. I came to the realization I wasn't going to be wrestling, which was, you know, again, not easy, but I prepared for that moment, Jason. My whole life helped me prepare for that moment. And so, you know, it was just fascinating. I laid there in the hospital with my pillow over my face when the doctor told me that I wasn't going to wrestle anymore. And I was crying. And I kid you not, within 15 seconds of me crying, and I'm a man of faith, the Lord said to me, Joe, you have so much going for you. This is not the end. It's just the beginning. I kid you not. It was basically those words went through my head, and they were spoken to me. And I stopped crying at that moment, Jason, and I realized I've been prepared for this moment. So it wasn't easy, but it is what it is. And I have complete faith that this is the path that I'm supposed to be on. And now I believe that I'm taking advantage of it and giving back in ways that are going to help others with their lives.
you get into coaching, you've got a couple runs, you coach at Cal Poly, you coach at Ohio State, then you end up getting a head coaching position at the United States Military Academy, Army to those who know it like that, and now Army West Point, as they like to be known. What was it about head coaching that you liked and you didn't like?
I love head coaching. There's probably not a whole lot that I didn't like. I actually liked the recruiting. I liked, I loved the development of the athletes and the wrestling sports. There's not a whole lot I didn't like. I think with me, it was just my itch for more. I wanted more. I wanted to more than just coaching, and I couldn't do that if I was just coaching because it's so time consuming. So I didn't want to just get caught in the coaching box the rest of my life, even though I did love it. And so coaching is just special. And I almost, Jason, almost was coaching again, because when the Pitt job opened, Heather Light, the AD there, was the AD at Ohio State, and we got in connection, and I actually went out to visit. It didn't end up working out, but there was a minute there where I thought I was going to get back into coaching because I did love it. But I was okay leaving it knowing that I have to explore. I'm not the guy that just wants to be comfortable. But when I left, I knew that there was a chance that I would never get back into college coaching again as a head coach, and I was okay with that. And I loved it. There wasn't a whole lot that I didn't like. I think the one thing that is grueling, I think there's a shelf life to coaching. I do, because it's very repetitive, and it is always, always on. I did not mind that, but I can tell you that I think after a few more years, I think that would have probably started getting to me a little bit, and I think it gets to most coaches.
What are some things about the military school aspect, the academy, the service academy, that traits that you saw in those cadets that you're like, that you may not have known about that factored into the type of person that you're trying to groom with the H leadership?
Well, you know, what's interesting is a lot of people ask me, oh, you have such special kids there. Well, quite frankly, they're special because they made a commitment to be great. You don't go to West Point and sign up to be average. It's just not really how that place is designed. So that's what's special. At the end of the day, there's still 18-year-old knuckleheads, 17, 18, 19-year-old knuckleheads. They're still kids, young kids, young adults. They still have hormones, and they still have desires, and they still make bad choices. And, so it's not because there's no, I go to West Point, I'm this, infallible human being, right? I mean, that's what I think some people are like, oh, they're so disciplined. No, they're actually not. A lot of the kids I coached were very undisciplined, but they were in a disciplined structure, right? And that's different. And so that disciplined structure helped make them men. And so there's a ton of parallel between H leadership and how, I challenge my cadets, my wrestlers, to be men and help mold them into men through the system that they were in at West Point. And how I want to do that with other people outside of the academy or military system. So there's a neat parallel there between what I learned from a leadership perspective, how I was able to implement leadership, how I was able to teach those young men who made a tremendous sacrifice and are making a tremendous sacrifice for our country, but also how to take that model and implement it outside of an academy.
Another thing to touch on is after you get out of coaching, you take an administrator position at West Virginia, which is interesting because at the time they were also going to go through just after I believe you were hired, the coaching search for Sammy Henson, if my timeline is correct. And when you go into an athletic administrative role, one, how often at these meetings with other organizations, the NCAA loves to have some meetings, but or within conferences that you encounter other people that were wrestlers. I think a lot of people believe that there are not that many wrestling administrators. Well, how many have you come across in your tenure at West Virginia?
Not many. Not many at all. There's ADs, and associate ADs, assistant ADs, associate ADs, and people within the administrative world. But at the upper echelon, your assistant and associate, there's not many. You have Andy Noel at Cornell and Bruce Baumgartner. At Edinburgh, Dave Martin at Oklahoma State. You have some younger guys coming up, Matt Valenti at Penn, and there's a few others out there. But it's not the norm. And I think that for us, for our sport to continue to grow, especially under the current climate of just finances and just cutbacks and just a lot of different things going on in college athletics, we need more people in those roles. And especially the senior level roles and the AD roles where we can be decision makers, because our sport, as you know, our sport is not in a great spot collegially.
We are seeing growth in terms of the women's wrestling level at the NAIA. We're seeing a lot of enrollment-driven schools add the sport of wrestling. There is a school that will be adding in South Carolina at the Division I level. We haven't seen that announcement come as yet as we record this on November 30th, 2017. But when you look at the topics that are prevalent in college athletics, it's pay for play, it's conference realignment, it's gender equity, it's everything that goes into being an administrator, and there's so many different ways you can get pulled. What are some things that the opportunity and the experience at West Virginia really did kind of open your eyes to in terms of what the world of college sports is actually about?
Money. We don't even have to go any further than that. That's what it's about. It is about money. And there is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. So finances, revenue, marketing, positioning, conference revenue, media rights, that's what it's about. And so I loved my time as a senior level administrator, but I also got hit with a real strong reality check because I'm a leadership guy. I'm wired to truly care about the student athlete, and the student athlete takes a back seat to the capitalistic approach of college athletics. And there is a huge disconnect between the actual investment and the development of student athletes and focus on and the drive and the thirst for revenue and positioning. So that's probably one of the biggest things that I saw. And for me, it was a turn on because you get into this political game, you get into this very almost nasty, bureaucratic, very territorial type thing kind of going on with some of these schools and some of these conferences. And as soon as that starts happening, Jason, for at least in my opinion, you start to lose connection with really why you're there. So I think it's a very fine line of balancing business and the development of student athletes. I think there's some things going on, don't get me wrong, to try to help create that gap, to fill that gap when it comes to student development. There's some things going on, but is it where it needs to be? Absolutely not, because the focus is on business.
Yeah, so that also brings a question to me now. As we've seen on social media, you know, like let's use University of Tennessee as an example. They are just they did not want Greg Schiano. That was they flocked to Twitter. They protested because whatever reason the University of Tennessee didn't want him. And a lot of the football and basketball and the revenue sports focus their energy on the money is comes with winning. You know, Nick Saban's making way too much money for what he does, but is he, because he's bringing in that much money from ticket receipts and all the ratings that go along with Bama football. Now, the question here is winning really important to an athletic department with these coaches in these non-revenue sports, or is simply, okay, don't get in trouble, make the grades, and bring in enough maybe tuition-paying athletes that you don't lose money as a program as much as, and don't get us like on probation?
Yeah, I think it's a balance. I think that's all going to come down to the leadership that you have in the department. I absolutely know some schools that they just want to check the box. And they want somebody in there that's going to be compliant. They want somebody in there that's not going to ask for too much. They want somebody in there that's going to stay out of trouble and all those types of things, right? And then there's certain leaders that expect, because really in college athletics, where the resources go, the expectations go. So just follow the resources. If a baseball program is getting a ton of resources, you better believe that AD expects them to win. Now, that goes without saying when it comes to your revenue sports like football and basketball. But when, Jamie Pollard steps up and does it, which I think was an awesome sign for college athletics, specifically wrestling, when you put that type of contract, which is somewhat unprecedented. I know some coaches are making some pretty good money, but I think a lot of the wrestling world was shocked. And quite honestly, you know, that's still, in some of the grand scheme of things with college athletics, a $300,000 salary or plus, and that's what some of the assistant football coaches are making, right? Many of the assistant football coaches are making. So for a head coach in a non-revenue sport, that's good money, but it's deserved. So bottom line is there always was, but there's expectations to come with that. There's expectations to come with investment. And it can be measured. Wins and losses are very easily measured. When you talk about student development and preparing kids for life after college, that's not easily measured. There's no real system that goes into that. There's measurements for academics. I can track their academics. But when it comes to how well we really prepare them, the system's broken. Or non-existent.
Having the opportunity to have coached at Cal Poly, which, as we look at the landscape of college athletics, they are in football championship subdivision or 1AA classified in some ways in terms of how they, there's the football schools, the FBS, which is like 1A, then the 1AA, then the non-football schools that are Division I, basically they used to classify as 1AAA. But the haves and have-nots, you're at a Power 5 school, you've been at a military academy, you've been at a small school that's essentially 1AA for football, and with a good history of success at Division II level at Cal Poly, and you know individuals here and there, where is the gap, and is it widening or is it closing between the Cal Polys of the world and the West Virginias of the world?
Widening, significant. I mean, and you can revert back just to the conference realignment a few years ago. You have your Power Five. You know, for those that don't know, there's 65 schools. There's five conferences known as the Power Five, and there's 65 schools within those conferences. And that's its own island. That's its own beast, right? So I think there's maybe 128 Division One schools or something like that. But 65 of them are your Power Five. So that separation, that classification is, that grouping is only going to get stronger. And it's designed that way. So there's going to be a gap because the Cal Polys of the world, they're not designed, one, to be able to bring that type of revenue in. I mean, you have more people standing in line in one of the gates to get into an Alabama football game than you have in an entire stadium at some of these smaller colleges and universities. So yeah, there's a gap growing, but that's the business of college athletics. So and that's kind of I would almost say expected. That shouldn't surprise too many people. But the other part of this is the development piece. Should a kid at a smaller school get developed from the standpoint of how they're prepared for life after college athletics? Should that be somewhat congruent whether you're at a small school or a big school? My answer would absolutely be yes. We should be, as a matter of fact, we should be able to develop because of the resources. We should be able to have more resources than Power Five to develop and ensure these young men and women are prepared for life after college athletics. So yeah, the gap's growing.
Okay, so what have you learned from being an administrator that says, okay, we can tell this to other Division I wrestling coaches, like here's how you help entrench your program on campus. Here's how you make sure that you're not in trouble with the ADs or you're not looking at the next budget cut and saying, are we on the block? And what are some things that you've learned that are positives that wrestling coaches are doing to make sure those things don't happen?
Well, I think you got to look at it not just in the sport realm. You got to look at it in the representation realm, right? Because you know, and what I mean by that is, if you look at APR, wrestling is at the bottom. If you look at skin infections, wrestling is at the bottom. There's a lot of categories where wrestling is not. If you look from the outside in as an administrator, as a college president, you're not going to choose our sport, right? I mean, you're not going to look at wrestling and see that it's on the bottom of all these things when it comes to the representation of a university and say, yeah, that's the sport I want. So I think that as an administrator, understanding how to create or recreate positioning from the standpoint of helping these coaches get better APR and figure out more things with skin infection and grades and all those types of things, that's what's going to help our sport. And we just need more people all in, because what happens, Jason, is if coaches is we get caught up in our own world. We do. And yes, I want to give hats off and throw a shout out to Mike Moyer and the NWCA for what they do in helping to try to bring more awareness and education around this, because the information's out there. But I still think there's disaggregation going on between by how to apply it. How do I actually work on these things to put wrestling in a light so that more presidents and ADs say, hey, that's a sport that we want. So from an AD perspective, even tying it into my coaching background, I think that that's where we really got to look at it, because it's not really about the sport itself. It's about the perception of the sport and the immeasurables that the decision makers are looking at.
As we wrap up things here with Joe Heskett here on the World Wrestling Resource Podcast, we've talked about H leadership. We've talked about priority thinking. We've talked about your experiences as an athlete and as an administrator. What are some things that Joe Heskett just has regular random thoughts about on a day-to-day basis? You're getting into coaching again. You're doing some private training. I mean, what are your thoughts on that individualized aspect of wrestling, and what's it mean for you to put the shoes back on and get in a room again?
Well, Jason, the last couple months has been crazy. So, when I left college athletics, I didn't want to be back in a box. There's a lot of ideas that I had, a lot of things that I wanted to do, and I absolutely loved my time at West Virginia University, but there has to be an alignment to get things done. And because of some of the bureaucratic structure, it's not always easy to get everybody on the same page to help these student athletes the way you think, or at least the way I think it should be done. So there were some challenges to try to get some of that done, and we were able to get some great things done. But bottom line is, I didn't want to put myself back in a position where I was bound by institutional guidelines or laws or rules. And, I'm really a collaborator. I want to work with people. And so the last few months, I've really been trying to figure out on my own, how do I make that happen? Now, fortunately, with age leadership, priority thinking, I've been able to transition some stuff. But this wrestling thing has kind of taken its own form over the last few months, especially. So now, not only have I gotten into private training, which has been great, but my private training is different. I'm not just about teaching a kid wrestling. I'm about teaching a kid how to be great in life. So my wrestling is called Beyond the Mat. It's very individualized. I do small group instruction. I do one-on-one instruction. I do max groups of six, and a lot of one-on-one instruction, or groups of two. And we really focus on getting better. And that has been so much fun because it's an atypical structure, right? Most clubs are out there. You have 50, 100 kids that run through the club. They come in, they run off, and they leave. AT leadership, Beyond the Mat, is all hands-on. It's about challenging them. It's about helping them become better people through the sport of wrestling. So it's kind of taking its own form, its own mold. And I have some plans with this, but I got to be honest with you. 6 months ago, I did not anticipate that this was going to happen, but there's been a demand, and I really even haven't even let a lot of people know about it. But the parents are starting to catch on and win, and I'm getting calls, and hey, what's this? I want my kid part of it. So it's really taking on its own form. But the beautiful part about it, Jason, is I'm able to impact lives the way I want to impact lives. And the one X factor in this whole thing is my children. My children are my number one priority. So for me to be able to carve out a schedule, and that's one of the tricky parts about coaching. Coaching is so demanding that, now that I can't spend time with my kids, but right now I have a 7, an 11, and a 12-year-old, and it is busy. So for me to be able to kind of really carve out my schedule to ensure that I'm there for them, especially as a divorced dad, I need to be there as much as possible. So that's my number one priority, and that's one of the drivers that I want to use to figure out how to really put a nice structure into place to impact people's lives through the sport of wrestling, through leadership, and to ensure my kids have their father very much in their lives to help them navigate through the same issues that I'm helping these other kids navigate through.
Defense Soap has revolutionized athletic hygiene in 2005 with the introduction of a bar soap containing natural ingredients proven to be effective against skin infections common to wrestlers. Today, Defense Soap leads the world in sports hygiene innovation with a complete line of bar soap, shower gels, and body wipes that contain high-grade tea tree, eucalyptus, and peppermint oils. Defend what you have built. Defense Soap at DefenseSoap.com. Joe Heskett, we could probably go on for hours on this, but as we finish up here, talk about H Leadership. You can find them on the web at HLeadership.net, all the social things. And if people want to get a hold of you, they want to find out more about H Leadership, how can they do that beyond the website?
Yeah, definitely. HLeadership.net is probably the best way to go. My email's on there. They can contact me directly. And for those in the corporate space, PriorityThinking.com, a very comprehensive website. See what we do to help increase organizational performance and our executive coaching. So those are the two things that I really love. And I hope that people check that out and give me a call, contact me, so maybe we can brainstorm on how to work together.
Subscribe to the World Wrestling Resource Podcast by going to WWRpodcast.com and check it out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spreaker, or wherever you find your podcasts. World Wrestling Resource at worldwrestlingresource.com.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.